This episode is brought to you by Odd Mo's Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, cider, and wine delivered. Call them today at 503-266-8444.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby.
Your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans. And its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
And if it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Hey, friends, and welcome to this episode of Now Hear This, Canby. I'm your host, James Walton. Let's read the news. The mayor of Malala is feuding with outgoing Oregon City Superintendent Larry Didway after the education official made comments equating a series of local flag-waving events with white supremacism. The events, which have taken place over a series of several weeks outside the Berry Hill Shopping Center on Cascade Highway 213 and South Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City, have mostly been peaceful and patriotic in nature. But some demonstrators have attended, sporting the trademark black and yellow of the Proud Boys, a far-right group with white nationalist leanings, according to the Southern Poverty Law Center and other watchdogs, though its members adamantly deny any bigotry or racism. We are angered by and strongly oppose the display of white supremacy groups in Oregon City on the last two Friday afternoons, Didway said in a message to students and families in the Oregon City community. We want to acknowledge and reassure our support to community members, students, and staff of color who experience the psychological, emotional, mental, and physical harm that acts of this nature cause. Oregon City School District does not tolerate or approve of these acts of intimidation. Malala Mayor Scott Kaiser was among those outraged by Didway's characterization of the flag-waving events, calling it outrageous and blasting his blatantly hateful and ignorant misunderstanding. For a person of leadership in the school system to be publicly and arbitrarily accusing a diverse group of citizens from his own community of being white supremacists is not only an insult to the participants, but unbecoming of his own office and of the school district as well. The flag waves involve diverse groups of local citizens who, quote, gathered to peacefully show their love and support for our country, he added. The event was carried out in the most peaceful, positive, and respectful way and was attended by people from diverse ethnicities, cultures, and age groups, Kaiser said. Had Superintendent Didway attended the event, he would have witnessed for himself the attendance and participation of Caucasian, African-American, Hispanic, Asian, and LGBTQ people groups, as well as school board members and an elected city mayor. Kaiser concluded by demanding Didway's immediate resignation or termination of Didway's job with the OCSD. Didway is currently scheduled to step down at the end of the month, as well as the rescinding of his new position and three-year contract with Clackamas ESD, and his permanent disqualification to apply for this position in the future. By his recent actions, Superintendent Didway has demonstrated exactly the type and level of disrespect of our flag, suppression of freedom of speech, and spreading of misinformation that the participants of the flag-waving event respectfully and lawfully oppose, Kaiser said. Do we really want this person to oversee our children's education? Didway did not return a request for comment. All right, good news first. Fewer than 100,000 Oregonians, that's less than 4% of the state's adult population, need to be vaccinated to reach Governor Kate Brown's goal of 70%, which would trigger a full reopening of businesses and event venues and scrap the mask mandate everywhere but a few places where their use remains the recommendation of the federal government. A less robust but still welcome reopening would come in Clackamas County if the countywide rate reaches 65%, a threshold that also appears tantalizingly close. Only 6,800 Clackamas Countyans would need to take the shot for the area to reach that mark, 2,000 fewer than the stadium capacity of the Malala Buckaroo, a July 4th event organizers canceled this year in part because of the continued uncertainty surrounding the county's reopening. But, and you knew this was coming, here's the bad news. Growth in both those metrics has been frustratingly slow in recent weeks and is trending steadily downward in the wrong direction. As of Tuesday, the state's vaccination rate stood at about 67.1%, an increase of fewer than 3 points from the mark set for 14 days earlier. Clackamas County's number was 63%, a similarly anemic rise from its pre-Memorial Day weekend mark of 60.2% on May 25th. In another metric tracked by the state, the percentage change in people vaccinated over the last week was down by nearly half, from a high of plus 9.4% to plus 4.9%, a clear sign that enthusiasm in the dwindling pool of unvaccinated residents is waning fast. In the Canby area, the number of people who received their first dose of the coronavirus vaccine rose by only 350 in the past 10 days, according to the Oregon Health Authority data. Brown and other state officials remain outwardly optimistic, stating just last Friday their belief that Oregon will cross its 70% goal by June 21st, less than 2 weeks away. In addition to the $1.86 million in cash giveaways and scholarships the state is offering to those who take their shot, officials have touted data showing the effectiveness of the vaccine in preventing serious cases of the coronavirus, saying virtually all of those who have contracted or have been hospitalized with COVID-19 were unvaccinated. For unvaccinated individuals, COVID-19 remains as large a threat as it ever was, Brown said in a statement this week. With more contagious variants spreading, far too many Oregonians are still being hospitalized when they could be protected with a vaccine. If you've been waiting to get vaccinated, get your shot today. But the flagging vaccine rollouts is not just a Clackamas County aberration. Although some counties have met the 65% vaccination goal, including neighboring Multnomah and Washington counties, and most recently Lane, the percentage of newly immunized residents is declining across the board. Oregon is one of only two states in the country, the other being New Mexico, that have elected to tie business reopening to state and county vaccination rates. Most states are already fully open, while a handful have set dates for reopening in the coming weeks. Canby Foursquare Church is hosting two COVID vaccine clinics this week, one on Tuesday, June 8th, and another on Friday, June 11th. The COVID-19 vaccine is free and widely available to people 12 and older. For information about clinics and availability, visit clackamas.us/coronavirus/vaccine or egov.com/find-covid-19-vaccine. Whew, that's a lot. Maybe you should just go to our website and find that information as well. You can also call 211 or you can email your questions to, listen carefully, covidvaccine@clackamas.us. In short, there's a lot of ways to get the information. If you have questions or concerns about the vaccine, consult with your primary care provider or trusted healthcare professional. More Republicans in the Oregon legislature are piling on the criticisms of Governor Kate Brown over her unique-in-the-nation approach to masks and business operations amid the continuing vaccine rollout. Senator Ken Thatcher, a Republican from Kaiser, on Thursday introduced a bill that would ban the use of a so-called vaccine passport in Oregon. Thatcher's proposal, Senate Bill 872, would prohibit public and private entities from conditioning service or employment opportunities based on vaccination status or the possession of a vaccine credential. The governor's vaccine passport scheme is an extreme invasion of Oregonians' privacy, said Senator Thatcher. No Oregonian should have to divulge medical information to participate in everyday life. This bill is about making clear Oregonians' rights, which would have been railroaded by the governor during the pandemic. One person cannot and should not have this much power over Oregonians' lives and livelihoods. The term vaccine passport has become increasingly associated with the state's prescribed policy of continuing to require universal mask wearing, except in businesses and venues where patrons' vaccination status is verified. As currently written, businesses are not allowed to refuse service or entry on the basis of vaccination status. The policy applies only to the use of masks in indoor settings. In theory, the policy lines up with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention guidelines that those who are fully vaccinated against the coronavirus no longer need to mask up, while those who are not should continue to do so. But in practice, Oregon's policy runs counter to the recommendations of both the CDC and the White House. The plan has drawn broad criticisms from both lawmakers and special interest groups for putting businesses and workers in the awkward position of requesting private health information from their customers. Our local businesses have gone through a lot this year, Thatcher said. The last thing we should be doing is making them play mask and vaccine cop. They have much more important things to do, like getting back to normal so Oregonians can earn a living. The bill is unlikely to progress in the Democrat-controlled legislature. It is currently awaiting a first reading, after which it will be referred to a committee by Senate President Peter Courtney. A vaccine passport ban was presented in Clackamas County this week by Commissioner Mark Scholl, modeled on a similar proposal that passed in Yamhill County. Though at least a couple of other commissioners, including Chair Tootie Smith, said they would have been in favor of a vaccine passport ban, the discussion was derailed by Scholl's repeated references to Jim Crow laws, which enforced the legal segregation of black people in the pre-civil rights movement South. Smith declared any future consideration of a passport ban in Clackamas County to be dead on arrival. The Oregon Senate has passed the state's version of the Crown Act, model legislation intended to prohibit race-based hair discrimination, including the denial of education or employment opportunities due to one's natural hair texture or protective style, such as braids, locks, and twists. It is an act of self-love for the black community to be able to show up at work and school in public places as ourselves, said Representative Janelle Bynum, Democrat from Happy Valley, one of the bill's chief sponsors. Based on the acronym Create a Respectful and Open World for Natural Hair, Crown Acts have been passed in at least 12 states since California became the first to do so in 2019. Data from the National Crown Act Coalition suggests that black women and girls are 1.5 times more likely to be sent home from work or school due to their hair. Black women were also 80% more likely than white women to agree with the statement that they have to change their hairstyle from its natural state to fit in at the office. Oregon currently prohibits school and workplace discrimination based on race, but the applicable definitions do not explicitly include hair type, texture, or style. The passage of Oregon's Crown Act, that's House Bill 2935, will ensure that the definition of discrimination includes hair type, texture, or style. Bynum said that the bill is part of a larger conversation we are having about who created the rules and who benefits from those rules. It's time for people to be able to express themselves unapologetically, she said. This bill will remove barriers to that, particularly for our young people, who should feel safe and welcomed in school sports and activities. Daniqua Jamil Rashid, a mother and community leader from Forward Together Action, was among those who advocated in support of the bill. As a black mama, I'm raising my daughter to love her hair, to feel proud of it, and to see it as beautiful, she said. I want her to feel good about her hair. While discrimination based on hair or hairstyle can be a real problem, Rashid said black people also commonly face awkward or uncomfortable situations based on their hair and the ways they choose to wear it, like unwanted physical contact or asking intrusive questions. We need the Crown Act because black children deserve to feel safe, to feel proud of our hair, and how we want to wear it, she said. HB 2935 passed Wednesday with only Senator Art Robinson, a Republican from Cape Junction, voting against it. Another senator, Dallas Hurd, a Republican from Roseburg, was an excused absence. The bill cleared the House unanimously back in April with 2 members absent and now heads to Governor Kate Brown for her signature. Now Hear This Sports is brought to you by Reif and Hunsicker. PC, when you need an attorney, turn to the firm Canby has trusted for over 50 years. You can call them today, 503-266-3456. Reif and Hunsinker, 503-266-3456. Thanks, guys. A Canby Cougar may be about to become a Beaver. Standout junior offensive tackle Jacob Strand received a scholarship offer this week to continue his athletic career at Oregon State University following a private workout with offensive line coach Jim Milkazovich. Strand, who was ranked the number one offensive lineman in the state by Prep Red Zone Oregon earlier this year, will play his final season with the Cougs this fall. Strand announced the Pac-12 offer on Twitter following the visit Tuesday. Oh, really happy for Jacob, said Canby head football coach Jimmy Joyce. He is a tremendous student athlete and a great young man, a true ambassador for Canby High School and our football team. Joyce said he saw the tremendous potential in Strand as a sophomore, which was his first year at the helm of the Cougars, and his athleticism and ability were on full display even during the truncated football season this spring. We are just happy that he has another year under the lights at Cougar Stadium, Joyce said. It should be a fun time for Jacob, his teammates, and the school. The NCAA lifted all COVID-19 recruiting restrictions on June 1st, and Oregon State was just one of the many schools quickly to take advantage. That Strand was one of the very first potential recruits to be invited for a one-on-one workout is a testament to the high regard Division I recruiters hold for the 6'5", 270-pound prospect. And it's likely just the first of many for the talented lineman and a number of his teammates. Schools can now have coaches on campus, and recruits can visit campuses as well, Joyce said of the newly reopened recruiting landscape. So, it has been a busy time. My phone has been ringing off the hook about Jacob and others. And that'll do it for the news of this episode of Now Hear This Canby. I'm James Walton. As always, thanks for listening. Have a great day.
Hey, Tyler, I was reading an article the other day, and I saw that 53% of Americans say they value technology even more since the COVID outbreak.
Oh, yeah, I think I saw that article in Obvious News Weekly.
Okay, you don't have to be mean.
Seriously, though, it is true. I know that I can't function anymore without all of my connected devices. And I heard that DirectLink saw a huge spike in internet traffic after the stay-at-home order began last year.
Yeah, it's a good thing DirectLink works hard to provide constant, reliable broadband service even during tough weather, peak use hours, and that big jump in increased demand.
Right, and we need access to a quality connection more than ever. We're working from home, the kids are still distance learning, and I've even had a few online doctor's appointments.
Yeah, not only that, but so many of our entertainment options have gone virtual. They're streaming TV shows and movies, Zoom game nights, and online gaming, so people really need reliable internet.
Wait. With all of that extra online activity going on, don't we have to worry about usage limits and high bills from using too much data?
Come on, Tyler. How many times have we been over this? DirectLink doesn't have data caps and doesn't charge extra fees for high usage. It says so right there on their website. Visit directlink.coop today to learn more. On the Canby Conversation today, I'm excited to welcome on a couple of guests. We have Michelle Lamont. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
And one of her sons, Ben. Hi, Ben.
Hello.
How are you?
Good.
How old are you, Ben?
8.
And how many podcasts have you been on?
This is the first.
The first one. Wow. Because that's great. You seem so confident, I figure you've done this before. He doesn't know what to make of me. I get that a lot from both kids and adults. So, Michelle, tell us a little bit about what you do and what we're here to talk about.
Well, we started the Monster Adoption Agency about a year ago.
No,
but
when Ben was five,
we started making monsters. He had a bad dream.
Okay.
And I thought, you know, we can do better than monster spray, you know, for under the bed. So
what's monster spray?
Just like I'm a huge fan of Pinterest, and so if you go on there and look, it's usually a bottle of water, and parents put like monster spray on the outside, and they have the kids spray the room before they go to bed.
Okay.
And so I thought, you know, we could do better. So I was trying to find something that would work, and I couldn't really find anything that I thought would work for Ben. So I thought
for the dreams.
Yeah, for bad dreams. So I was like, well, what we could do is have him draw a picture, and then I can sew. So I was like, well, I'll put that together, and then Sully, as you can see, or Mr. Fuzzy, Wyatt has Sully, but they're very loved and very worn.
Yes.
And they go everywhere with them. I don't think Ben slept with him one night since, or without him,
yeah.
One night since. And he's just, it's his favorite thing.
Yeah. Ben, do you remember what the dream was about, the bad dream that you had? Scary dream?
It's probably like about, So when I was 5, I used to like Thomas because I used to watch him when I was like 5.
Thomas the Train. Yeah.
But this like yellow thing has been eating them.
Ooh.
That's my bad dream.
Yeah. That does sound scary. And how does Mr. Fuzzy help?
By eating the bad dreams.
Oh,
you want to show him?
Mm-hmm. And inside.
Oh, he's got that mouth. Okay, yeah. Opens up. Oh, that's so cool. It's got like a night sky pattern inside of his mouth. And so that takes
it. And
yeah.
Moons.
That's cool. And so that takes the bad dreams. And you haven't had so many bad dreams since?
I did not have a lot of bad dreams.
That's great. Wow. And what kinds of things do people say when they see you walking around with Mr. Fuzzy?
Where'd you get it?
Where can I get one?
Yeah, we get that a lot.
Yeah. Okay. So would you like to hear the thing? I draw the monsters with Wyatt, the monster maker that's playing with...
The other monsters is what we're talking about, right? So that's what I was going to ask your mom about, because that's a really cool story, but we have an even bigger story to tell.
So, which one?
As far as the other monsters that you guys are making.
Yes. That is actually Ben's thing that he came up with when he was 5.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because after we made his, and it was such a big success, he wanted to give them to some of his friends in his class.
Oh, cool.
And his teachers. So he made...
That's a great idea, Ben.
He made
and
one
then
first.
And I wanted to, after when I made some for my class and some for my teacher, then I wanted to give monsters to other strangers.
Mm, mm.
His goal is to give one monster to every kid.
Okay.
I'm good at sewing. Yeah, I'm good at sewing, but I'm not that good.
Right.
So Ben's learning to sew, and that was his goal when he was 5. And so this year, we really kind of ramped it up.
Yeah.
And we started with COVID and these kids, kindergartners on Zoom.
Mm.
That doesn't go well. So, you know, Wyatt would get stressed out, and he would start crying.
Wyatt, and he's your 5-year-old.
He is my 5-year-old.
Yes.
And he wanted to help the other kids in his class because he saw. And so him and Ben were talking, and they decided, well, we could probably do one for each kid. And I was like, whoa, now. And so
they were struggling with just the things you could imagine, the challenges of the isolation, the not being in school, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and having to just do everything on the computer, a bunch of 5-year-olds, you know, that's hard for them.
Yeah.
So I asked the teacher how many kids there were in the class, and she said that there were, I think we ended up making 15.
Mm-hmm.
And we gave them to the teacher to hand out for Christmas.
Yeah.
And so his entire class, and they had a monster party on Zoom and everything. So that was kind of cool.
That's cool.
And
I should just say, you know, check our website. We have story photos of these things. If people are like imagining like scary monsters or whatnot, they're so fun. They're so colorful. They're like,
yeah, they're
really
kind of
cute, like
random. They're drawn by the boys.
Yeah.
So just imagine a kid's drawing of a monster.
Yeah.
They have a zipper mouth, like Ben said, and you're supposed to, the idea behind it is that you leave it open at night and it eats the worries.
Yeah.
We've actually made them for adults also, you know, I have one.
Yeah.
You know, you just hug them and it's like a stress reliever thing.
Anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we've made a bunch of them for teachers and counselors, like school counselors.
Yeah.
Preschools like them.
Yeah.
They're washable. That was my only thing that I told Ben and Wyatt when they were making them, is as a parent, it needs to be washable.
Yes.
But, you know, we just kind of took off with it. We mostly do donations. We do have a website, and we do sell them. For every monster that we sell, we can donate 4.
Wow.
So
cool.
It's ambitious right now. We're making for the Dougie Center. We've dropped off 50 so far, and we are in the process
Dougie
of
Center
making 50.
The Dougie Center deals with children that are impacted by trauma.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, like grief support.
Yeah, grief support, yeah.
So what the Dougie Center is going to do is give those out for Christmas. So we need to do another 50 by the time Christmas rolls around. Ben wants to donate to the Children's Hospital, and we've had a teacher friend of ours that's battling cancer, and she donated some of her head wraps, like, to make the monsters, so that it would be like a piece of a cancer survivor going to kids that need them. So it was like, that's a really cool, exciting thing to do. And it's fun. I think to date, I was trying to figure out how many we've made. And I was trying to figure out by how many zippers I've purchased off of Amazon, because I was like, that's the best way I can do it. I don't really keep track. And I found, Ben, can you go check on Wyatt, please? I found out that we have sold, or not sold, but donated about 520.
Oh,
at
my
this,
goodness. Wow.
That's a lot of sewing.
Yes. And you do them by hand? Do you use a machine? Or?
Oh, yeah, I do a machine to sew them. But then when you sew them up, you sew
cut
it by
them
hand.
And, yeah.
Yeah, but it's that's the part that actually takes the most that I didn't think about when I started was the cutting.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense.
But, yeah, so we've put them together. I've tried to replicate some monsters that the boys have designed that I thought were really cute, and I cannot do it. Each one is so unique.
Wow, that's funny. So not, not mass produced at all. And I have to commend, you know, for it to, again, I'm looking at Mr. Fuzzy here in Ben's absence. He's coming back now, but it's very well loved. I can't believe that it's only 3 years old.
I can't even wrap my brain around how many times that thing's been through the wash. Because it goes camping, it goes hiking, it goes everywhere.
Do the kids name each design? Do they have stories that they tell? Or is it just the design most of the time?
They do the design, and then they pick out the materials.
Okay.
And then we send a sheet out that explains a little bit of the background of the monsters.
Okay, cool.
And, I mean, it's... I should have brought Ben's book. He's got two books that he's filled up of just drawings of monsters. At first, we used to send the drawings out with the monsters, but then I kind of wanted to keep them. And we put them on the, we have a Facebook Stitcher Designs page that has, whenever we make a monster, we do take a picture and post it on there.
Okay.
So that if people want to go and check them out, it's kind of hard to do because it's a made-to-order thing, like if people want one, and they can design their own. You know, I've had people send me pictures that their kids have drawn, and we've recreated them and then sent them out because it's more special for the kid that way, I think.
Oh, that's so fun. Cool. Awesome. So what is the website? How can folks find out more and support?
It's stitcherydesigns.net, or if you go to Facebook, it's stitcherydesigns, one word.
Okay.
And they can find us there. It's like I say, we're just mostly donations. We donate the monsters, but you know, if there's a kid that wants one, the parents can go there and purchase. And like I said, we don't keep the money. We actually put it in a place so that we just use that strictly to make more monsters. So we can donate four every one that we sell. And we also started, I keep forgetting because we just started doing it, but Cookie Pots Children's Boutique in Gladstone.
Oh, cool.
We it's a concession store, and we sell them there too.
Awesome.
So.
Yeah. I bet it makes the kids that receive these either, you know, at the hospital or through the Dougie Center or wherever, or even at class, makes them feel so special to have something that's unique and made just for them.
Yeah, it is. And even, like, the stories that I hear from teachers and the school counselors, that they say it just makes a world of difference. Like, it really helps. And we've donated a lot of them. And the teachers say that kids, usually with autism, who aren't good at communicating with adults have no problem communicating with the monsters. And so it's so fun to hear those stories, though, that, you know, they're helping. They're making a difference. You know, it's really comforting a child. And it's like, wow. And so me and Ben were sitting down, and we were figuring out how many zippers, and we were like, okay, so over 500, and we just ordered more. And I was just like, wow, that's amazing. And so I told Ben, I was like, that means that we have touched you know, the lives of over 500 kids so far. Yeah, yeah. And we're ramping up, not slowing down. So I told my mother-in-law, you really need to learn to sew so you can help us me. Because that would be great.
You're just like deputizing people, random people on the street. Can you sew?
You're going to sew. You're going to sew. And when I put on Oregon City Chit Chat, I put out a call, you know, hey, if anybody has any material.
2,000 reactions. It was insane.
It was insane. And so many people donated.
That's where I found out about this. Yeah.
Yeah. And people were so generous, you know, and they were like, yeah, you know, I'll donate fabric. There was a very sweet lady who is a quilter, and she donated a bunch of fabric scraps, and she felt bad because she's like, I don't know if you can use these. You know, they might be too small. Well, like I said, Ben's practicing. He's learning to sew.
Yeah.
So I start having him just sew the little squares together for practice.
Yeah.
So then we ended up with these long fabric strips, and we started putting those together. And so some of the monsters really look like a quilt because it's, you know, really mismatched fabrics.
Yeah,
and
cool.
We weren't thinking when we were putting it together, just, you know. And it ended up being an adorable monster. I'll be posting pictures of that one, too.
Yeah.
And it was nice because that way, you know, she didn't just donate and we toss it. You know, we did use it. Yeah. So it ended up working out really well. And I'm excited about that one. I was like, oh, it's really cute. I want to keep it. And my husband's like, you know. And I was like, I know, for the kids.
I remember. I know. Yeah. Do a lot of the teachers and the other folks that you partner with for the kids, do you know, do they tend to use them similarly to your children as far as opening up the zipper at night? They're kind of there to catch or capture the bad thoughts or dreams?
I know that some of them do. We've made some monsters, and the people have kept in touch or for the boys' friends that have them, and they say that it's really a comforting, like almost like a bedtime ritual that they go through.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing to hear those stories and to know that it wasn't just, you know, something that got tossed or whatever. Yeah. And the teachers would say, you know, on the Zoom meetings that they would see the monsters on the kid's bed or somewhere in the background, you know, so they could tell that they were, a lot of the times they'd pop up randomly on the on the Zoom meetings or something when I was on with Wyatt, and it was just nice to see that it is making a difference.
I love it. I love it, and especially like you said, you know, this kind of started with the monster spray and the idea that kids might be scared of monsters. So to take that and turn it into a friend, and turn it into something fun and some show that it's not something to be afraid of, I think is so cool. Anything else you want to share?
I don't think so. Okay. I need to get Wyatt. Hey!
We need to finish up with Ben over here. Anything else you want to share?
Go get Sully. Do you have any?
I just want to say I think it's so cool, Ben, that you came up with this and that you and your mom and your family were able to touch so many kids' lives through this really cool idea.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Ben. Thanks for talking to us today. Mm-hmm. Want to say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Joining us now is Donna Ellison of Ellison Team Homes, a firm serving all across the Portland metro area with three realtors based right here in Canby. Donna, can you tell us how Ellison Team Homes started?
I started in real estate. I grew up with my dad. He was a realtor. Mm-hmm. So I'm a second generation broker, and I grew up with him on weekends. And I learned a lot eventually working with him for several years and then going out on my own. Our family moved to Canby a couple of years ago, but we really didn't know how it was going to go. And within the first probably 3 months of being here, we literally fell head over heels in love with this place. We love the community, the spirit here. The first Christmas at Waite Park, I was literally crying because everybody was walking around saying Merry Christmas and people were drinking hot chocolate, and we got in a carriage ride with the horse, and it was just too much. You just realize it's special here. Real estate's always been my passion. It is my professional love. I enjoy the people, the relationships. So much comes out of kind of the intensity that you spend with people. You're really up in their business for a period of time, and sometimes it's a couple months, sometimes it's a couple years, sometimes it's a lifetime.
Yeah.
I feel very blessed at this point to have people that have been with me for almost my entire career. Mm-hmm. Clients that have bought and sold maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 homes. I have one client that's bought and sold 8 homes with me.
Yeah.
3 generations. It's a beautiful business. It makes for a very full life.
Mm-hmm. How can people find you?
How can they not, really? we have a website, www.ellisonteamhomes.com.
Well, thank you, Donna.
Thank you for having me.
Canby Then is brought to you by Retro Revival. They are not your average antique shop. They're open daily, and you can find them on the corner of Northwest 3rd and Grant Street in downtown Canby. If the city of Canby were a wheel, then Waite Park would be the hub. The city revolves around it. It is the host of many of the city's most popular and well-known events, from the Canby Independence Day celebration, once known as General Canby Days, to Light Up the Night, which draws thousands to downtown Canby each year to help ring in the holiday season. Today marks the start of a new series on Canby Then, looking at the history of the city's parks. They play a much more important role than you may realize. They are the places children play, yes, but one day those children grow up, and the lives they lead and the futures they build are shaped in no small part by the dreams that first began to take shape on the playgrounds of their youth. Waite is the city's oldest park. Though it was not officially deeded to the Canby until 1967, its history goes back much further than that. The property that would one day become Waite Park was part of the original 1870 plat for the city of Canby filed 150 years ago. It was part of the original donation land claim of Canby that founding father Philander Lee, the Oregon Trail pioneer who grew amazing whiskers, but also apples, which he shipped by train and sold to miners during the California Gold Rush. Just to the north was the claim of Aaron E. Waite, whose descendants would eventually own the land and donate it to the city, and after whom the park is named. Waite is a fascinating and influential figure in early Oregon history. It is well known that he was the first Chief Justice of the state's Supreme Court, but he was so much more than that. Aaron Waite was born in Whatley, Massachusetts, on the day after Christmas in 1813. His father was a soldier in the War of 1812, which actually lasted until 1815, and was killed in action shortly after Aaron was born. He was raised by his uncle and grandfather. At the age of 14, he became an apprentice broom maker in Hatfield and put the money he earned towards his own education. At age 20, he moved to Long Island, New York, where he taught country winter schools and was an assistant teacher in Erasmus Hall, though he would later confess he never really liked teaching. He eventually returned to Massachusetts before moving west in 1837 and settling in Centerville, Michigan. There, he befriended Judge Columbia Lancaster, who would also be influential in the early governance of both Oregon and Washington State. Young Aaron had taken an interest in political matters since he was a boy, a biographer once noted, and he had always been a Democrat. During the presidential campaign of 1844, he edited a Democratic paper in Michigan and afterwards held the office of military secretary in the cabinet of Governor John L. Berry. In the spring of 1847, Waite headed to the Oregon country in a wagon train of 40 ox-drawn wagons. His party included Judge Lancaster and Lancaster's small family. They arrived safely in mid-September of that year. Watchful care was exercised, and no serious accident nor difficulty occurred on the journey, Waite's biographer noted. Other than being tiresome, the journey was not an unpleasant one. The one colorful episode history preserves involved the spectacles Waite wore for nearsightedness. Native Americans who noticed the strange facial adornments asked what they were for, and Waite said they allowed him to see a long way off. The natives avoided him after that. They had misunderstood his explanation to mean that the spectacles made it so he could see anything, anywhere. Once in Oregon, he set up a law practice in Oregon City and entered into an agreement with Oregon's first governor, George Abernathy, to edit the fledgling Oregon Spectator. The Spectator was the first American newspaper west of the Rocky Mountains and would soon become the main paper of the region, used by politicians for public debate of the leading topics of the day. It had little competition. Before the Spectator, the only newspapers circulated in the territory were tiny pamphlets printed in San Francisco and Monterey, which were delivered by ship at random intervals, and, bizarrely, a paper based in Honolulu, Hawaii, which at the time was commonly known as the Sandwich Islands, for reasons that are much less hilarious than you might guess. Some folks also received letters and papers from the States once a year by immigrants coming down the Oregon Trail.
When the Cayuse War broke out, sparked by the massacre of missionaries Marcus and Narcissa Whitman, whom Philander Lee and his family had met on their own journey to Oregon, Waite was appointed first assistant commissary under General Joel Palmer. While in that capacity, Waite was tasked with securing provisions for the troops in the field. No easy task. Legend has it that someone told him, "Go to God Almighty Smith." He was able to give. "He won't, but you try him." This Alvin Thompson God Almighty Smith was an accomplished carpenter on the Tualatin Plains, which we know now as the city of Forest Grove. He was, in the word of one historian, a serious man who did serious work. He was a devout Christian from his boyhood days. His nickname had been bestowed on him by the Indians, who heard his frequent prayers to God Almighty. And as one of his contemporaries, Dolly Hinman, would recall, quote, "Mr. Smith was a very stern man, keeping the Sabbath from sundown Saturday to sundown Sunday, and woe betide anyone who did not do likewise." Obviously, Aaron Waite had his work cut out for him. He arrived at Mr. Smith's late in the day and made his errand known. Never one to make a quick decision, Mr. Smith said, "You must stay with me all night, and we will talk it over." Well, old man Smith must have heard a still, small voice during his prayers that night, because he did indeed agree to furnish equipment for the soldiers in the field and rendered other aid. He even accompanied Waite to another settler's ranch near the foothills, where the two men procured a drove of hogs for the War Department and its hungry soldiers. God Almighty Smith's home still stands on Elm Street in modern-day Forest Grove. It is the second oldest building in the city and was added to the National Register of Historic Places in 1974. That house fell into disrepair and was even home to a meth lab in 2005, but was saved through the heroic fundraising efforts of the Friends of the Historic Forest Grove, which raised $175,000 to purchase and restore the property. Their efforts included, and I'm not kidding, a sexy calendar featuring members of the group in various nude poses. We were told it was quite tasteful. The name of the calendar, of course, was The History Buffs. God only knows what the good Alvin Smith would have thought about that. We'll have more to tell you about the adventures of Justice Aaron E. Waite and the Canby Park that bears his name, but it'll have to wait till next time on Canby Then.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears? Even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Canby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Canby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yep. Heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Canby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately like caught off. That's cool.
Yeah, they also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Canby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Canby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City, or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net. Now Hear This Canby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Canby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms, used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Camby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.